Logan Ledger, welcome to Roots Radio. How are you?
I'm doing mighty fine.
Thanks for coming over on what is now a beautiful fall day.
It is. This reminds me of some San Francisco weather.
Well, which might last for several hours or 10 minutes under conditions like this. But you're from the Bay Area originally, if I understand it correctly?
Yeah, I mean, I was born in Los Angeles, but my parents moved pretty quickly up the coast. So
Bay Area music scene, super diverse. It does have a great traditional thread. It's got a jam thread. It's got David Grisman and Jerry Garcia. And what parts of it touched you?
Well, I mean, the shadow of Jerry looms large over pretty much any musician from the Bay Area. I was familiar with the Dead's music as a kid. I didn't really become a Grateful Dead fan until my 20s. Kind of took me a while. I think it's one of those things where you tend to push back against, you know, what's sort of the status quo of your childhood or whatever, you know. And in my case, sort of the hippie legacy is kind of like the legacy of my parents' generation and my friends' parents, you know. Kind of took me a little while to embrace that. I think in the early days, I was very much interested in just hardcore, traditional, old folk music. You know, I used to collect Smithsonian Folkways records and, you know, the Rounder series that dealt with old-time music and country blues and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And in that way, I think maybe my journey kind of parallels someone like Garcia or, you know, a lot of those 60s rock and roll guys who started out as folkies or whatever, you know.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. We have some of the same heroes, Doc Watson and Mississippi John Hurt especially.
Yeah.
Who turned you on to Doc?
So I had a guitar teacher, my only guitar teacher, really, this guy named Nick Shryock. You know, I was just starting to learn how to play the guitar, so I didn't really know anything. He gave me a book of Bob Dylan songs with chord charts, so I learned those, and that was my intro to Bob Dylan. And then he gave me a little instructional primer on the music of Mississippi John Hurt, which... I think he gave to me because it was, you know, music it's sort of deceptively simple, but it's something that a beginner could sort of approach. He was a classical guitar player, so it was all fingerstyle music.
Okay.
And I really dug it, and then I got into Doc Watson, and I was all about fingerstyle folk guitar for a while.
Right.
When I was a young teenager, so, you know, 13, 14 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, I got into the banjo. I think the first banjo music I heard that really set my heart on fire was actually Pete Seeger.
Yeah.
Doing If I Have a Hammer, or If I Had a Hammer, you know.
Yeah.
And that's kind of funny, you know. It's like, I really was kind of like this old, like, leftist folky when I was a kid, you know. Loved Woody Guthrie and, you know, protest music and labor union songs and coal mining protest ballads, all that kind of stuff.
That's great. Well, don't ever lose that.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm sure it will be part of your music forever, even if it may be buried in the sediment a little bit under the sound you're making now. When did you begin to kind of think, I could see myself on stage doing this, playing original songs? When was your first real gig, as you think of it?
Well, it was a slow process. I mean, I've always sort of been interested in performing. When I was a kid, I played, you know, I acted in school plays and I sang in, you know, vocal groups, but I didn't really do anything outside of school, really. You know, it was all definitely programmed for the parents' enjoyment. Mm-hmm. But I started writing songs when I was about 14 or 15 years old. You know, I made demos and, you know, some of those got out and people... you know, kept asking me to play songs. So sort of later on in high school, I started, still at that point, it was mainly still covers. I was playing old folk songs. But I didn't really have a real band where we were playing original music until college, which is when I was in a bluegrass band called the Guilford County Kings.
Okay.
And
where was that?
It was in New York. I went to Columbia University in New York.
Oh, leapt all the way across the country.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Went to the hub of the folk revival.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that was kind of the idea. I sort of had this romantic notion about it still, which was sort of misplaced. But it led me in some great directions, and I met a lot of great people, you know. When I was in college, I spent most of my time working at the college radio station, WKCR.
Great.
Which has a pretty long, you know, legacy of student radio. And the show that I DJ'd for was called The Moonshine Show, and I think it's still around. And they it was just old-time music and bluegrass. And in some incarnation, it had existed since, I think, 1968 or something like that. So, you know, it was kind of this long line of DJs that had passed the torch.
For me, and for so many, I'm sure for you at some point, you know, one of the draws of old-time and traditional and bluegrass music is the jam culture and the picking parties. Mm-hmm. Where did you begin to sample that
work? When I was a kid, I went to, you know, bluegrass festivals, and I met people that, you know, were like-minded, and I went to jam sessions. And pretty early on, but I don't think I was super confident in my abilities at that time. You know, I was mainly playing banjo and then mandolin a little bit too.
Hmm.
And I was a decent Scruggs player, you know, but I wasn't really, I wouldn't really sing in the jam sessions, not until later. It took me kind of a while to build up my courage.
Oh, wow.
But yeah.
Well, that's pretty interesting to reflect on, given the way you use your voice on these recordings, because that's what grabbed me. You are singing with a sense of style and phrasing and attention to detail that is just great. So let me just pay you a compliment.
Oh,
I love
you.
Your voice. And you're singing in a idiom that would, you know, could be a little bit of country politan. Of course, you're working with T-Bone Burnett, so we have this almost new ambient, sweeping, gorgeous kind of soundscape.
Mm-hmm.
That's not totally identifiable. Then there's some steel guitar with Russ Paul, but really your voice and the way you curl it, and especially on the song Starlight, there's the Bakersfield overtones.
Mm-hmm.
So let's just jump right into kind of your intent. Well, I want to back up a little bit in a minute, talk about Nashville and arriving here, but you know, given that you mentioned your voice, when did you begin to really embrace the sound that
well,
we hear here?
I mean, I've been singing since I was a little kid, before I could even remember, even if I wasn't doing it publicly.
Mm-hmm.
And I did, by the time I was in high school, I was singing in front of people, you know. I spent a lot of time just probably trying to imitate people. You know, when I was a little kid, I was obsessed with Elvis and Orbison and, you know, vocal groups like the Platters, you know, the Flamingos, that kind of stuff. You know, like the music, the golden 50s music that my grandmother introduced me to.
That's nice.
Mm-hmm. And then I got into bluegrass, and I started trying to do that. And it's just been a long process of trying to emulate people. And then at a certain point, I realized that you got to have your own style. So I think I just tried to amalgamate everything. But then also kind of be deliberate about what I wanted to do with it. Make sure it suited my own natural timbre and voice.
Right.
You know, it takes a it's long important. Time to get comfortable. At least it did for me. It took a while for me to really develop my own sound and style. I don't think I really had one until I'm, you know, my 20s.
That's natural.
I
mean, yeah.
Yeah. But it's, you know, it's important, I think, to do your homework. You know, I think it roots me in a tradition in a way that wouldn't have been the case if I hadn't done that work, you know.
Well, how did moving to Nashville figure into that, where you've got Studio B and a lot of, you know, the history of this place, you know, follows you around, and it's easy to tap into, and it's exciting. That's why I came, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, once again, I think it was sort of this romantic notion of moving to Nashville and making it or whatever, you know. I really didn't have any prospects here. I had a couple friends that were living here, you know, that I knew from college, and I wasn't really able to afford to live in the Bay Area, and I couldn't really get a good job, or I didn't really know what to do. You know, I was right out of college, and I was playing in another bluegrass band, which was fun, but it wasn't really scratching my musical itch, so to speak. I wanted to be playing, you know, straight up honky tonk music at that time.
Okay.
So that was part of me moving to Nashville. But once again, it took me about a year and a half, 2 years to find people that wanted to do that and were, you know, on the same page as I was. But yeah, when I moved to Nashville, I had this idea of you know, playing basically Ray Price style music, Texas right. shuffles and things like that.
So where'd you go? Because this would have been maybe 2013. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And by that point, Lower Broadway is almost, it's crazy at that point. It's almost hit its boom. So getting down there is not quite like when I was exploring it in the, you know, around 2000, when it was pretty quiet. You could, sometimes, you know, yeah, there weren't any cars, but there were incredible bands and Roberts. How did you approach Nashville?
Well, it was kind of random. Basically, I met this guy named Leo Grassel, who is a steel guitar player, who we had a mutual friend, and he had just moved to Nashville. He took me to this party where I met all these guys that were in this band called The Benders. Hmm. And we were just having a jam session, and they heard me sing, and they asked me to join the band. And we became this band, you know. We played honky-tonk songs, and we played at the old Foo Bar.
Yeah.
And, you know, weddings.
Foo Bar's in East Nashville, yeah, formerly known, but still there in another name.
Yeah, exactly. We were just a ragtag, you know, mm-hmm, honky-tonk band.
Right.
And then me and another member of that band named Kevin Martin ended up joining this band called the Cowpokes, which eventually became the house band of Honky Tonk Tuesday Nights, which is this ongoing series of concerts that happens in East Nashville at the old American Legion Hall. And yep, that's sort of where most of my connections were made at that point, maybe about 3 years ago.
That makes sense. It's the most interesting and dynamic sort of core of country music in the city right now, I think, these last few years.
You know, that sort of hipster cowboy movement, which I was very much a part of, and sort of, you know, I guess I still am.
So one of the people you met proved faithful is the remarkable musician Dennis Crouch, player.
Yeah.
And as I read it, Dennis helped hook you up with T-Bone Burnett.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's an interesting story. Should I tell
you
it?
You should tell it.
Okay, well, so I had this other another friend named Mark Thornton, who I had brought into that band, the Cowpokes. He was this guy I knew from going to jam sessions at my friend Adam Wright's house. Guitar player.
Wonderful.
And he you know, plays sort of gut string guitar in the style of Jerry Reed or, you know, Chet Atkins, all finger picked, thumb pick guitar. And he's just a great guy and a great musician. And he has a studio that he runs out of his house that mainly he would do bluegrass projects out of, you know, lots of instrumental bluegrass projects. And one day I was over at his house, or his studio rather, and he had this microphone that he had just gotten in the mail, this weird looking sort of space age, space needle looking microphone that didn't really even have an obvious, you know, point to sing at, you
okay,
know?
Right, right. It's a stick.
Yeah, just a
mystery,
stick.
A
yeah,
mystery stick.
But like, you know, a stick that eventually went into a point.
Yeah, I've seen those, right.
Yeah. Okay. So he's like, hey, Logan, why don't you play a song into this thing? So without even thinking about what I was doing, I played a couple original songs, one of which is out. It's called Starlight. Mm-hmm. And then another one, which is going to be on the record, called Let the Mermaids Flirt With Me. And, you know, didn't think anything of it, you know, left. That was it. And then a week or two goes by, and Mark calls me, and he says, hey, Logan, my friend Dennis Crouch came by, and we turned those songs into real demos. I'm like, what?
Mm-hmm,
that's crazy. So, you know, I gave him a listen, and they sounded great. You know, Dennis had overdubbed some bass. I'd never met Dennis up to this point. I knew who he was, but, you know, I didn't know him. And Mark, you know, had added some guitar, and they sounded awesome. So another week or so goes by, and I get another call from Mark, and he says, hey, Logan, Dennis sent these demos to T-Bone Burnett, and T-Bone wants to meet you. Like, I mean, this is just crazy. I mean, at this point, I'm just playing in cover bands, working at a, you know, bar, and not even really writing that many songs. I mean, I wasn't doing it in the sense of, oh, this is for a project. It was like, I was just writing songs to write songs for myself, really. And I would kind of sprinkle them in my cover sets, you know, but I wasn't. At that point, I was just trying to learn country music and you know, put on a good show of somebody else's songs. So it was crazy. I mean, this is just sort of totally out of left field for me.
Wild. That's great. So how'd you meet him?
I went to Mark's place, met Dennis for the first time, got on the phone with T-Bone's assistant, and booked a flight to Los Angeles and went there, I think, the next day.
Wow. And if anybody out there is thinking that Dennis Crouch is some sort of groovy, aloof, you know, kind of cat with some dark glasses and nose T-bone from, he's like the sweetest family guy. Yeah. He's just like this unassuming hillbilly musician who plays great bluegrass, but also toured the world with Alison Krauss and Robert Plant.
Yeah, I mean he's just the same old guy that came from Strawberry, Arkansas, but he's, you know, has the technique of like the finest classical double bassist, you know, in the world. I mean, he's just an incredible, just world class musician. But you know, he's just a super humble guy. And
if Roy Husky's alive and well, it's in Nashville today. It's Dennis Crouch.
He's incredible.
You didn't just meet T-Bone. You worked on recordings together. Can you describe kind of, he's a really interesting guy who can be very diffident or very warm, and he's super creative, but it's always hard to figure out like how he expresses his creativity and puts his stamp on things and lifts up the best parts of an artist. So tell us about that experience.
Yeah. So, I mean, I had the luxury of basically getting to know T-Bone for a couple years before we ever started making this album. I mean, we made demos, you know, several demos over the course of about 2 years, but really it was just a process of getting to know each other that I think, you know, I was just lucky to get that time. I played in his band the only two times I think he's played with the band in the past 3 years, at the Hardly Strictly Bluegrass Festival, which was a real honor and a really cool experience.
Playing guitar?
Playing guitar and sang, yeah.
Great.
As part of a, you know, larger band.
Mm-hmm.
So I've just established a great rapport with T-Bone, and I kind of, you know, I view him definitely as a mentor and a, you know, a guide. He, has been incredibly generous with his time and, you know, he's, you know, given me lots of great advice. So by the time we got in there, there was nothing uncomfortable or weird about it. You know, I can imagine someone who was in my position that didn't know T-Bone as well being kind of intimidated by the process or not knowing really what to do or how to navigate that situation. But for me, it was really easy. I mean, I also had known the musicians for a long time too. And, you know, I made a point of really trying to make it, you know, even though these songs definitely were my vision and had been developed over the course of a couple of years playing live shows and stuff, I really wanted to make it this sort of collaborative process. And T-Bone played guitar on everything. He was the first person in the studio and the last person to leave. I could tell he was very personally invested in this project, and it meant a lot to me.